We're talking about fatherhood and the company of men in this episode today with Yusuf Lawson. Now, Yusuf is a guy that was born to British Caucasian parents. He got married to a Pakistani woman. I believe she's Pakistani. So he's had an interesting set of experiences. He was still born Muslim, which is a rare case for a British guy, I suppose. That's given him a unique insight. He's a big lover of Pakistani culture, believe it or not. He's spent a lot of time in Nottingham. He is somebody that I've known now for about a year and a half, I think. He's trying multiple things. He's a community leader. He has a full-time job. He's a father. He runs a coffee shop as well. He does a lot of things. But he has a unique insight on society and the world. I've always enjoyed his company. I spent some time around Christmas time in his coffee shop, and my initial intention was to just spend an hour there, an hour or two at the coffee shop, and come back home. And I think I got there around about 11 a.m. I didn't come home until about 6 p.m. as I was enjoying myself so much, and it was just banter. It was just conversation with whoever came in, and just the environment that was created in that coffee shop was really great. So I will bring Yusuf on board, where he can talk more about himself, about who he is, what his life is like, and his views on men, fatherhood, bonding, and socializing with other men. When men were men. When men were men. So Yusuf, just tell us a little bit about yourself. Just general stuff, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I live in Nottingham. I'm just here visiting Khurram for the day. I've been working here in London. I'm a civil engineer. So
I do. Sounds not interesting.
Well, it's interesting to me.
Is it? Are you genuinely interested in it?
Yeah, I definitely am. Yeah.
All right, fair enough. Yeah. But I thought you were an architect.
You thought wrong.
Didn't I?
Furthest from architect, you could...
I don't know why I thought you were an architect.
Civil engineers and architects usually clash, because architects do fancy pictures and engineers actually have to build the thing, so...
Oh, but if you speak to most people, architect seems like a more impressive title than civil engineer.
Yeah, they do the big ones. Fancy projects and the glamorous stuff, but when it comes to actually building the thing and making it work in real life...
He's a civil engineer.
The role of the engineer, yeah. Mm.
But you were the person that was responsible for getting Broadmoor shut down in Nottingham as well.
Not quite.
All right, fair enough. And you're married?
I'm married, yeah. I have 3 children.
You have a wonderful son.
I do, he's 10 months old. Yeah. And I have 2 girls as well, who are 5 and 6.
Really great. And you're very good with them as well.
Thank you.
You're a good dad.
Thanks.
And how long have you been married?
Been married for 7 years, just had my 7th year wedding anniversary.
Very nice.
In May. Got married at 21.
And that's young.
Yeah.
Very young.
Well, when you know sometimes.
That's good. Quite rare these days, isn't it?
Yeah, people, I don't know, everyone's sitting on the fence.
But this is what I noticed about you. You are rare for this day and age. I mean, if you go back 30 years... somebody at 28 would have 2-3 kids, would have a house, and would have a job like a civil engineer. Mm. Whereas in this day and age, somebody at 27, 28 is probably barely even married, let alone has a house, especially if you're in London, because we're in such a hyper-individualized society and people are growing up later and later. You've had a very different trajectory.
Yeah, it does present its challenges, though, because obviously all of my friends are just catching up now. They're only just starting to get married now.
Yeah.
Some of them, not even all of them, the first ones are starting to have kids, you know. So my kids are kind of a generation, not a generation, but they're quite a few years ahead of a lot of...
Well, it will be a generation, won't it?
Ultimately.
So you're probably hanging around with people who are much older that
have
got kids at your age.
So the people who are older and they've got 3 kids, they're in their mid-30s to heading towards their 40s, you know. And while, you know, that's fine, it's just my immediate friends that I grew up with, they're not in
their... They have single lives.
They're still either bachelors or only just getting married. So
it's very different.
Yeah, and you need couples, they need that other couple's
They need other
community, right?
couples,
And
yeah.
kids, you want to have, if you have friends, you want your children to be friends with their children, and it builds a, the childhood memories and friendships are going to last for long times. And if
But you've been able to do that, though. It's not been a major
to a
challenge for you.
degree, yeah, to a degree, obviously, like you say, sometimes being friends with older couples, and I have brothers and sisters, and they I'm the youngest of five, but they're starting to have their children as
But you,
well.
because you got started a lot sooner than all of
I
them as
was the
well.
first one, yeah, to have children, but
Make people like me feel very insecure.
really, well, that's on you.
But very, yeah. I mean, I'm almost
That's
touching 40 here.
not on me. Yeah,
But these kind of things are not in our control. I don't think they're. You can have the intention. I wanted to get married when I was 21, but I didn't get married until I was 31. It's just not in my control.
Yeah,
You know, and now that I want to have kids, it's not there. But then I've done other things a lot sooner than other people. I went on Hajj when I was 20, and I meet people now that are 40 and saying I need to go on Hajj before I hit 40.
Or even people who are 60.
Yeah, because
Incredible.
I think I was speaking to somebody, I can't remember who I was speaking to, and he was saying, oh yeah, I was at some barbecue a couple of weeks ago, and this guy there, he was saying that you go to Hajj and like 90% of people there, 95% of people are 60 years old plus. Because there's this idea of, you know, you get married, you have kids, you got your house, you do everything, and then you do Hajj.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, it was completely upside down. I did Hajj when I was 20, and my sister was 12.
Well, I guess that it requires a certain level of maturity to be able to do Hajj. It's not a light thing you can just, it's not on the radar of the younger generations. Maybe that's symptomatic of the societies we live in, the priorities we put on
Yeah,
things,
I think the
but
priorities,
also the maturity of people. You'll
yeah, the
find that.
priorities have definitely shifted in the last 20 years, definitely.
Yeah.
I think so. I think the
Yeah.
priority seems to be a following on Instagram and
Yeah, it's true. And also people's interaction with the deen, and
it's changed.
it can get relegated to just a pastime or something that older
Yeah.
people do, or it's not instilled in people,
But they now realize they also have a choice because they've been the way the religion gets thrust on them, it just puts them off and pushes them away anyway. Because there's no magic there, is there? I mean, I got put off when I was raised as well. I just thought, what is this? It's just boring. It doesn't have any solutions to any of my problems. Now that I'm coming back to it, now it's all the solutions are within the deen.
It's the way you're taught, I guess. It's the priorities or the emphasis on which part of the deen that the people who you
Which has
learn
always been
from when you're a
ritualistic.
kid, yeah.
Yeah.
When you're a kid and you go to madrasa, it's almost just like child minding.
Yeah.
There's no
Outsourcing their parenting to the state
or
or to the
to the
madrasa.
Maulanas who's just
Yeah.
gonna beat you with
With
the stick.
the
So it just
I've had
yeah,
my share of that.
yeah. I think we all have.
Yeah.
But that instilling love for the deen and the sweetness of the deen in the children
And the magic of it.
is a huge huge part of it. And something which
So are you trying to do that with your kids?
I have. Although I haven't pushed them into any kind of formal
Yeah.
teaching of the deen, like that, my daughters are 5 and 6, well, 5 and a half, 6 and a half. Their birthdays are in February and March, and I have never kind of forced any kind of. I've taught them. Obviously, we live in an Islamic lifestyle, and I've taught them the different adabs of eating with
Yeah.
your right hand and these kind of things, and those kind of day-to-day mundane things. But in terms of starting madrasa or learn Arabic or learn Quran, that kind of stuff, I've never really
Taking it
forced
easy.
it. Yeah, they're actually going to start in September. There's an intake in September at the local madrasa, and it is a good madrasa. It does attempt to make the deen accessible for kids and make it fun and enjoyable and make it about the more of the truer essence of the deen.
The thing that I've noticed with you, like, is you seem to have a lot of time for your girls, for your kids altogether. There's a lot of dads, they can be physically present, say, but they're emotionally absent, which is not something that I've noticed with you. And also, you're a lot calmer. Like, I remember, well, two instances that I remember that really stuck out in my mind. One was when we were at a wedding of a friend, and they were just doing a really light, basic dance, not like a big. it wasn't like this whole kind of satanic thing or anything, but
no.
just, and you really participated with your daughters, and I could just see the magic in their eyes, how much they enjoyed that. And I thought to myself, you know, if I was a kid and if my dad did that with me, and that would have been, I think that's a really, it was really, really precious, just the way you indulged them in them having a little dance and stuff.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I remember was when I came to your coffee shop, because you have you're a co-partner in this coffee shop in Nottingham, right?
Yeah, Espresso Gallery.
Espresso Gallery,
yeah.
Where we did a Ertugrul quiz night about a week or two ago.
Yeah,
it was good fun.
It was good fun.
And I remember, like, when your son was, I think, how old would he have been in December? About 4 months.
4 months or so. He was born in September, so
three months. And you were in the coffee shop, and you know, your wife brought him in on that little baby holder thing.
Yeah.
And you were perfectly happy for the customers to play with him and spend time with him. You weren't getting all possessive and precious about it. I know, obviously, you had to run the coffee shop as well, but it wasn't... I think you'd be happy for that to happen even if you didn't have to run the coffee shop.
Yeah, I've always been that way with my children. I want them to be open to people and sociable. You know, you can be way too overprotective with your kids. You think you're doing them a favour, and really you're setting them up for a detriment, really. You're closing them off from people. You know, you want to, as far as I'm concerned, have your kids to be comfortable with people. You know, there's a lot of anxiety in children. You don't want to put anxiety on children. It's my job to keep them safe, but they don't have to know that I'm keeping them safe, if that makes sense.
Yeah, perfectly.
I can
keep
control of them, make sure that they're safe and doing whatever they need to do, but they're blissfully ignorant, and they can just have their fun and they can be with people. And if I deem someone suitable for them to interact with, you know, I can make that decision, and the children can just be relaxed and interact with people.
Very nice. But I noticed as well, like, we went for a walk just to have a look at some shoes, and we were in the Nike shop. There's a little kid there playing with his football in the Nike shop. Now, I love kids, but I'm very afraid to interact. I'm very afraid to interact with other people's kids until I have a green light to say this is okay. I've had situations where I've interacted with a child of somebody else's, and they've been very precious about the whole thing. And it's a really bitter taste that it leaves in your mouth. It's a really horrible feeling, because you're just doing it because you want to, there's some joy to experience and stuff. But I noticed that you didn't have any of that reservation. You started playing with the kid, you started playing football in the middle of the night store in the outlet.
Yeah.
And he actually wanted to do it with you even more. And the dad was kind of, I don't know, I kind of felt like the dad was a bit concerned, but he didn't say anything.
I think from being a parent, my concern is always that my child is bothering someone else.
Right.
So he may have thought that his child, because the child was playing around with the football, his dad was distracted.
Yeah.
He was on a video call showing trainers to someone else.
Yeah.
And he will be conscious that his child is distracting or causing trouble or getting other people's way or whatever. Because I would have those same feelings if I was in a shop, and I would tell my children, don't get in people's way, or you know, don't bother people. But if he can look at me and see that I'm smiling and I'm just interacting with the child and just being like, it's fine, then I think that may have put him at ease, and then, you know, we're just playing.
Because my general experience has been, you're bothering my child, as opposed to my child might be bothering you. It seems to have flipped in the last decade or so.
Yeah, I guess there is more.
Which is not something that you have. You don't seem to have that about you. You're just worried, is my kid bothering someone else? But you don't have this. I mean, obviously, you want to protect this increase in child abuse and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You want to protect them from those things, but you don't have this air about you of, why are you bothering my kid?
Yeah,
you're okay.
No, I think that, like you said, an air about someone, like, people do have kind of, they give off, certain people give off a certain vibe. Like, I can look at someone and they're trying to interact with my child, and I can kind of get an instinctual kind of reaction that this person's safe with my child, or this person's not safe with my child, you know? So from when it's me, I'm quite relaxed. And I know that because I spend time with children, I mean, my own children, I know how to interact with children.
Yeah,
I'm comfortable.
You've got a knack for
Re- interacting with children. So when I interact with someone else's child, they can get that feeling from me that I'm comfortable interacting with their child, and I'm not. You know, it's just, I guess it must be like some sort of micro expressions or something that you know, that
just sends off that energy
or that signal that you're comfortable with the child, or that you're not gonna, you're not a threat to the child. Mm. I don't know. There must be something. There's lots of things that we pick up as human beings, we sense from other human beings that we may not consciously register.
Yes, yeah, a subconscious thing.
Put us at ease or put us at suspicion.
Yeah. But the thing is that the child in the knack shop, he'd not only known you for all of 11 seconds, but he was behaving with you as if you were his best mate.
Yeah.
He warmed to you very, very fast.
Mm.
And he probably would have loved to spend another hour with you easily.
Yeah.
And that would have felt like 3 days to him.
Sure. Well, kids, if you're not stiff with a child and you kind of playful, kids looking for anyone that will play with. He's playing and his dad's not interacting with him. He wants to be playful with his dad and his dad's not interacting with him. Mm. And someone else is being playful, then he's getting that thing that he wanted from his dad that he's not getting because his dad's distracted or doing something. Mm. And it's not just not saying anything bad about
the dad. Yeah, of course. He was genuinely busy. He was genuinely occupied.
He's neglecting his child, but he's in the moment. Somebody have to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
So if he can get some sort of playful response from me, because, you know, I was kicking it to him and I had made a little game about, you know, moving the ball around and made a little game of it. And, you know, he just appreciated that, the child did. So it's about being, just be calm and be natural around the children.
But don't you feel like, I mean, now in the last 10, 15 years, don't you think that kind of, this idea of kids interacting with elders, you think that's shifted quite a bit, and the way that interaction takes place. I mean, I was giving a talk at, it's probably best not to mention the venue or where it was, but I was giving a pretty important talk about 4 months ago now, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a teenager that was there that came in, and he just fell asleep in the middle of the... I mean, I had barely started and he was already asleep. You could tell this was a kid that hadn't learned to interact with adults at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just had no concept of it. His mum was very interactive. She, you know, but the child had... I don't know whether he'd been mollycoddled or... He'd just been cut off from the world. And so he had no sense of awareness about him.
Yeah.
About how am I coming across the other person? Whereas when I was raised, you were told that when you enter a room, you greet everybody and you speak when you're spoken to. But if you do have something to say, there's you wait for an opening and then you speak. And then, and that wasn't done in a royalty kind of way, but neither was it done in a you're a peasant kind of way either. There was a balance to it. It was a nice, it was a good upbringing in that sense. It was good to learn those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I've kept that the rest of my life. And I've noticed that that affects me even now. Like, I go somewhere and I speak to an elder and they can immediately tell that this person is somebody that knows how to interact with an elder. Whereas I feel like children don't know how to interact with elders anymore.
Mm.
How do you feel about that? Because you've got this coffee shop. You have experience of a lot of people coming in all the time.
Yeah.
And you're a community leader as well, so you do meet a lot of people.
Mm. I think they're obviously, with the way society is going, the natural disposition is to be wary or to be, suspicious, you know, because bad things do happen in society, and with social media and stuff, you hear about every little thing that happens, you know. I think there is that initial kind of resistance from parents to... And also a protectiveness of their children. And it's natural to be protective of your children. And I guess because we don't live in societies where everyone knows each other, you end up meeting a lot of strangers. Mm. I guess it depends on the parents' disposition as well. Some people are very nervous, very anxious, very protective of their children. Depends on their own story with their children. Maybe it's their only child. Maybe they had lost a child. Maybe they struggled a lot to conceive the one child that they do have, you know.
So then they become a lot more...
They're more protective, a lot more, you know, if you're an only child. Because I'm the youngest of five, and it was always very kind of relaxed at home. Like, you know, I was never...
By the time they got to you, they were very relaxed with you.
Exactly, and I'd go out and play with my friends, and, you know, I lived in a...
Whereas the first child they might have been more protective of.
Exactly, you know, and... how your parents interacted with you will influence how you interact with your children, and so on. You know, these are kind of taught. These relationship kind of interactions are learned. You know, and I guess my parents are quite laid back and were laid back with me, and you know, I can be like that with.
So it basically transmits, doesn't it?
It does.
From each generation, it does keep transmitting.
Hmm. And on the inversely, the traumas, they do get passed on as well.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, I've heard about this a lot now. I mean, Dr. Gabor Mate speaks about this, that, you know, if you've got a trauma or an anxiety, you're silently going to transmit it to your child without you even realizing you're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like an energy transfer.
If you don't address it.
Yeah, if you don't address it, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's these transgenerational phenomena, yeah. transgenerational traumas. If they never get, and they can go really deep.
Like, oh, yeah.
Like generations yeah. to the point where it's affecting your life now.
And you don't have
and
no
you
idea.
Don't have to know where it came
yeah.
from.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
you have this very important. We don't have this thing of lineage. We don't know who our great grandparents were, or great grandparents. We don't know who they were, or what their lives were about, or how what things affected them.
So I read this book about 3 years ago, which was called The Emotion Code by Dr. Bradley Nielsen, and he talks about, like, you know something can happen to you in your childhood, for example, and because of the way that you form a judgment on that, what that event means to you at that point. Determines whether it becomes like some. You can have some traumas, like, you know, I bust my chin when I was a kid. It didn't really affect my life in any way after it healed. It wasn't really an issue. Don't even think about it. But there are other traumas that I've had, like apparently I refused some food or something when I was a kid, and then my uncle locked me outside the house for 5 minutes at 11 o'clock at night in Pakistan somewhere. That traumatized me for a pretty long time. It made me quite afraid of the dark. So there's different things. So you assign meanings to certain things.
Yep.
And so in this book, what he does, he teaches you how to get... He says that what happens at that moment is that you don't get a closure for that event. You haven't learned to reconcile it in your mind.
Yep.
So he gives you a mechanism for releasing that emotion, because it becomes a trapped emotion.
Mm-hmm.
So he gives you a mechanism for releasing it. But one of the things that he talks about is... inherited emotions, so that you can have an emotion from an ancestor, like going back 3, 4, 5 generations that you have no own memory or recollection of, but it's there. And I remember when we were going through this process, and my wife was really enjoying this process of releasing the emotions and everything. And then when we got to the inherited emotions, she just felt like it was very hocus pocus, very like, oh, this is all kind of airy fairy. And it's only now, in the last kind of couple of weeks, and especially exactly with what you're saying right now, that the trauma keeps getting passed on from one generation to the next generation to the next generation, that you don't even know it's there. And it's not this hocus pocus stuff. It's just being silently transmitted until somebody breaks the chain.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's no... You just need to be aware. Being aware is enough sometimes that it's there. You can't always fix it. You know, you can't... have a cure for everything in terms of these things that happened years and years ago, because if it's generations, you may not have a fix for it, but to be aware of it and understand how it is affecting you now, that is the
just to open up your eyes.
Yeah.
So what, like, one thing that I've noticed in my family, for example, men and women, but especially the men, is that we have a lot of fear of authority in our amongst our men. So the council and the you know, somebody says, well, some legal lawyer or whatever, there's a lot of this kind of, especially if it's a British person. And I've noticed that I had this for a while, but it recently, in the last few years, it's kind of disappeared. And I realized that it was a lot of this had to do with the fact that the British went over to India and they were giving it all the men a really hot, because obviously the British were a lot more... you know, there's certain rules when you go and invade a country or whatever, and those were a lot more lax for the British, so they were affecting the women and children as well. But generally speaking, it's the men of the family that get lynched.
Yeah, right? Brunt. Yeah.
Yeah, they got the brunt of it, so that's why the men had a greater fear of it. And I started to realize that I remember now, because my granddad passed away like 20 years ago, I didn't have much of... I had a fondness of him, I didn't have that much of a relationship with him. But I now realize that I remember seeing that in him. I can recollect it. And I've seen it in my dad. But I've thankfully been able to break that curse now. I don't have it as much. And probably because of social media and, you know, proliferation of information, it allows you to kind of recognize it and open your eyes to it.
I think a lot of young Pakistani men will be experiencing the same thing.
Right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I see it. I grew up with Pakistanis. I've got a lot of young Pakistani friends. And there are these things that hang ups from the whole era.
And they don't even know where it's come from. It's just a reality for them. It's just a way of... That is the truth for them. That's how the world
is. Also, it can manifest in a kind of rebellious attitude.
Yes.
You know, like they think, oh, you know, they don't, it's not conscious, but they feel like they have to resist and they have to break the law almost, you know, in a sense of act of rebellion against the
And this
British
is
law.
Incredibly prevalent in like Nottingham, Rotherham, Sheffield, all these kind of places where you've got large Pakistani communities and they're all always in trouble with the law all the
Yeah, you
time.
get that bad boy Pakistani kind of mentality or attitude.
Which is probably where this comes from. They can't reconcile it in their minds, can they?
But
now, have you had any of this trouble, Yusuf?
What trouble?
Trouble with the law.
No comment. No comment, officer. No, to be honest, we had quite a good, strong group growing up, and we were there for each other, and we kind of looked out for each other. And you know, people would misbehave and whatnot, but we always kind of kept each other within the bounds, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, that we never
The
went too far.
misbehaving is really more about having fun or curiosity, though, isn't it, really? It's
Yeah.
not really rebellion per se.
It escalates, it gets to certain degrees, and I'm not sure what it is, but certain things will exacerbate it, you know, and drive people to push the boundaries or rebel more and more and more. You know, but me and my group, we never really had that. We got went to a certain limit but didn't cross it, you know. And maybe it's because we were balanced, you know. Obviously being from a British background, maybe I added something to the group that they could see in me. He's English, but he's not here to dominate us or to persecute us or whatever. And they can kind of reconcile that maybe to a degree, you know. And we ended up just being naughty teenage boys or whatever, you know, up to the correct limit, you know,
There's a boundary.
rather than going and going and going and going and you know, because they do get, the thing is, they do get pushback from law enforcement,
Yeah, of course.
you know,
And
because.
the law enforcement, they see this so much that they automatically have a knee-jerk reaction as well. Because they've, you know, if a police officer's been in the force for 20 years, he's seen every guy that he comes across that's of a particular ethnicity, there is a stereotypical behavior. I mean, I saw this in there was a video going around from Bradford about a month or so ago, and you know, the police, there's like five or six cars, and some guy's just decided to park his car somewhere, nobody can get out, and they just want a fight with the law enforcement, they just want a fight with the police. And you think, but this isn't achieving anything, because this is creating a lot of noise for the rest of the neighborhood. Everybody's asleep. This is like 1 o'clock in the morning. So there's a lot of police cars. There's a lot of aggro. There's a lot of noise. So you're just, so to get your own way, you're actually disturbing everybody else. So even if on principle you feel like you should have a, you should have a run-in with the law for whatever reason, or because we've been persecuted by it for so long, there's a way of going about it.
Yeah, but that's because they're not
And that place
when it's
isn't
not I
notorious for this. I
when
mean,
it's not
Bradford is notorious.
identified, it's just a kind of a wild unleashing or lashing out, you know. But once you
Animal
can,
instinct.
yeah, once you can kind of understand it a bit better, you could maybe apply that resistance that you feel that you need to have in a more productive way,
In a controlled way, yeah,
in a controlled
exactly.
or productive way. Go into, you know, study law or something and do something in that vein. Well, I don't know, or I'm not really sure what the correct outlet is, but maybe it's just about reconciling it and
They just
realizing
need an
that,
excuse to vent, or just always angry all the time.
or just realize why they're angry and then decide that, well, that time has passed, and this situation is different, and we have to understand the time and the place that we live in, and react accordingly to that, and not be, you know, reacting to events that have happened generations ago.
But you're not an angry man. You're not one of these guys that's always looking for a confrontation or always looking to break the other guy down. You're not one of these guys, but you're also not, you're very aware of your own masculinity. You're not an effeminate guy either. You don't have the kind of, you're not passive, but you're also not aggressive. You seem to have quite a lot of balance there. Where has that come from?
I don't know, maybe you could say having a good wife, you know, behind every good man is a great woman. So, you know, if you are made to feel like a man by your wife, then you don't need to go looking to exert your manliness on other people.
That's interesting.
You know?
Very interesting. But you know, you had the privilege of being able to get married early. There are guys that genuinely can't get married until they're 30, 35, which means they're not getting that validation. So what are they to do in that time?
Well, I would say get married.
Well, I'm saying, you know, if
Yeah,
it's
if they
difficult.
can't.
And also, you know, there is this idea of you know, the guy is not the project of the woman. It's not the woman's job
No.
to fix the guy. It's not her,
Certainly not.
you know, it's not. So
No.
what do you do in that
My,
situation?
well, on that particular point, my approach to marriage has always been that the as the couple, the role each other, your duty to the other is to help them to be the best version of themselves that they can be. That's the dynamic that you have to, the man has to responsibility to his wife and wife to the man, that each play their role and help each other. But in terms of if you're not married, I don't know, it's keep, I think it all boils down to good company. You know, if you have the company of good men, you know.
What do you consider a company of good men? What do you consider like a good man, a good company from a good man? What does that look like? Because you know, some boy in the hood in Nottingham or in Rotherham, for him, good company is some guy who can jump in a fancy car with, you know, some souped up BMW that they can drive at 100 miles an hour on. Well, not 100 is quite tame these days for them. Or just terrorize the streets, have a car that makes a lot of noise, you know, these big exhausts and everything, and then go and get some nice dessert and a bit of hookah and all that kind of stuff. It's not really, but that for them is very good company.
Yeah, it's true. Well, this is the thing, that there is a great tradition within Islam of what it is to be a man, what it is to be noble.
Which is what?
Well, I think the manliest of all men to have ever existed is the Rasul Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, you know. So
But what's the defining characteristic for you from him? What was the.
it's a hard one. It's not the one you can just pin down in one specific element, you know.
Okay, so, but describe it to me. What. Describe it to me in feeling. How are you. When you know you have good company, or company that is really good and good men, what does that look like or feel like? Even if you just had to describe it physically or in the way that it makes you feel, what would that look like?
It's a good question. I guess the people who remind you of Allah, the people who take you closer to Allah than pull you away from Allah, that's good company.
So when I was at, I remember when my dad opened up the first shop that we had. Well, this was actually the second shop, and there was a lot of people that used to come in there. And my dad made some very good friends. And I was just going to start going into university at this point. And this guy came, was a good friend of my dad's. I became really good friends with him as well. He was a really nice fellow. And he said to me, he said that when you go to university, you should really go to the. And he wasn't a particularly religious guy, particularly, but he said to me, he said, you should go to the Islamic Society because that's where you're going to find guys that are good company and guys that you can trust. That's all he said. He didn't say they'll remind you of Allah and stuff. But I have to admit, very honestly speaking, that obviously it's Allah's will. You know, you go through the experiences of what form who you are. But if I was going to make that choice today, or if I said to my, if I had a son, I don't know if I would necessarily say to him, the Islamic Society is where you're going to find good guys, because that was just full of very toxic. I mean, if
It's
you were to use the
true.
word, if you were to use the term toxic masculinity, that's where it was ever present. It was more present there than it was outside of
Yeah, a lot of
there.
people have the same experience.
Yeah.
Even me at the university, when I studied,
Which
I'd go
university was that?
Nottingham Trent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that would have been a breeding ground of.
The same thing, like, yeah, I'd agree with that it's not the place where you meet the best people, unfortunately.
So where is that place? Because it's not the masjid either, because it's full of old fogies.
It's true. A lot of my best friends are people who I've known for for years. I don't know. But then again, the other half, like a half of my, some of my friends are people who I've been best friends with since I was like 4 or 5 years old.
Mm.
Yeah, but other people who I've only known for short amounts of time.
And like me, for example.
Like you, for example.
You've only known me, what, a year, I think?
Is that it?
No, about a year and a half, is
something,
it?
I can't remember exactly, but yeah, something like that. Mm. You know? I can't put my finger on exactly what the thing is. It's...
You know. Don't you think that guys are really struggling to find good company, to be completely honest? And they are spending time with other guys because they have a need of wanting to socialize and stuff.
Mm.
But deep down, even to themselves, they know this isn't really right company for me.
Yeah, it's true. I think it's the people that will help you towards... I think everyone is asking themselves the question of, who am I?
Mm.
And
so guys that help
what
you
am I
to,
doing? What is my purpose?
Yeah. So guys that help you to know yourself better.
Yeah.
Guys that are a mirror to you.
Exactly.
So your brother is a mirror, basically.
Mm, mm. People who can help you in that innate kind of mission or purpose in life. Someone who can help you towards finding your purpose in life. There's a sweetness of being with someone who lifts you up.
And there's a camaraderie to it, right?
Camaraderie. Someone who helps you to be better. Someone who lifts you up. Someone who has concern for you, and you have concern for them. Genuine concern. Someone who you're not trying to get something off, and who you feel comfortable that they're not trying to get something off you.
So this is exactly what in the previous episode, Harris and Zeeshan said the exact same thing. This theme of that, especially Harris came to this that. You know, now it's life has changed so much, even though obviously he's only 20, he's very young, but he can see the pattern of things has changed, where most people are meeting each other because they're looking at what's the benefit, what's in it for me to meet this other person,
yeah,
as opposed to what can I do for this person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that seems to be in a major switch.
Yeah, this concept of futuwa, of nobility within Islam, is rooted in preferring the other over yourself.
Mm.
I think that's one of the core principles, to have that approach when you're meeting people, that I'm going to put this other person's needs above my own needs, and they're doing the same to you. So by naturally competing to put the other person first, you both get raised up.
Mm.
You know, and if, because it's like a stepping stones, you do it, then they do it, then you do it, and you move upwards, rather than you're doing it and they're not doing it.
Yeah.
And you just end up going down.
Yeah.
You sink. So if
and that friendship becomes a lot more sweeter.
It does.
But it takes time to get to that point.
Yeah.
And it takes having an open heart and an open mind and a lot of things, right? It's not something that happens within an hour at all.
It's true. I think
people don't have the patience for it anymore either, do they?
Well, unfortunately not. Sometimes you hit it off with people straight away, though. You can just sense something in someone that this person...
Yeah, you and I did have that, because I think I met you at...
Where did we first meet?
I met you in Norwich.
No, I phoned you.
Did you phone me?
Yeah, I phoned you and said...
No, I met you in Norwich, then you phoned
me.
No,
you did. Oh, yeah, we met at that night of Dhikr.
Yeah, so we went to this Dhikr, and I met you there, and you were actually more interested in me than I was in you at that time.
Cheers.
I think it was a bit overwhelmed.
It was after you'd done that that video with Sheikh Omar.
Yeah. So it was a little while after that, yeah.
Yeah, and then I found out you were in Nottingham, so...
Yeah, and then you rang me, and then I think you wanted... did you want some advice on some business or something like
no,
that?
No, I think we were talking about blockchain. Was it blockchain?
Yes, blockchain, yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about blockchain.
Little bit,
I got a bit interested in blockchain, and you'd been doing some work on blockchain, so we kind of came together on that.
And then we met for a breakfast.
Yeah, breakfast, yeah.
And then that was kind of like, that was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can, and I guess that's, you start to work someone out, you kind of...
Yeah, you know, get an idea of do I want...
And people always have good qualities and bad qualities, and it's whether you as a person can overlook the bad bits and enjoy the good bits, you know. And some people, everyone has a different scale, like there's maybe certain things about a person that I can get over and manage and be fine with, and other people that's too much of a stumbling block for them, and they can't, no matter how much good that person has to offer, this thing that they can't deal with, they can't get over, stops them from being friends with that person. And maybe that's just
and that tolerance has gotten lower and lower now, hasn't it?
I guess people, yeah, they people's faults are magnified.
Yeah.
You know, this also part of nobility is overlooking people's faults, you know, and being aware of your own faults. You know, so you put the other.
What if you get to a point where you're hanging around with someone that, by overlooking all of their faults, you're actually enabling their behavior all the time?
Yeah, and you've got to be mature enough to realize that that's not healthy. And that's
so
not
you are you're exercising that as well then?
Of course.
There's a balance to it.
Yeah, I think we're drawing out some key principles of what it is to make good friends. And I think discrimination has to be one of those things. To be able to discriminate between what
not
is
discrimination
okay.
as in racism.
No, to be people who can...
To be discerning, basically.
To be discerning, yeah, and to know the limits, the boundaries of what is okay, what's not okay, what things are okay to overlook and what things aren't okay to overlook, you know. And sometimes people, you have to interact with certain people in certain environments, but you have to be mature enough to know that, well, if I put them in this other environment, then it's not going to work as a relationship.
Yeah, I have noticed this as well. There are certain friends that you can have. When we did this Ertugrul quiz night, for example. We had this quiz night where we did this TV series Ertugrul. We just asked, you know, we just have a bit of fun, which you kindly helped me organize, which was a really nice evening. But I know that there are some people, I mean, this is in Nottingham. I don't have that many friends in Nottingham, but let's say if it was in London, I know still there would be some characters that even if they enjoyed Ertugrul, getting them in that environment probably wouldn't be the best thing.
Sure.
And so I wouldn't force them to come because I just don't think it would work. And in both ways, with what they would have to say to me about it and then what they would say to others as well when they arrive.
Mm.
But my friendship with them on a one-to-one basis is still okay.
Mm. Yeah. So you have to be able to know the situations and manage them.
Okay.
It's not a simple thing. It's a complex matter.
All right. Well, one of the themes that I've got as part of this podcast is I want to ask this question to everybody that comes on. So it's a two part question.
Mm.
So the first is off screen, in your own personal life, so to speak. Who do you consider to be a man? What's your somebody who's an embodiment of it, of what a man is?
You want to know a name?
It doesn't have to be a name, but it can be somebody. It can be a relationship in your life or somebody you know or.
A man's man.
Well, it doesn't have to be a man's man. What's the definitions that you've been giving me so far of what a man is?
Mm.
Who's somebody that you know that fits that bill?
Mm. To be honest with you, a lot of that this thing of being a manly man is something that is very important to me. So I could say a whole list of people who I would consider close friends, and I would, one of their main qualities is that they have those.
Okay. All right, so there's lots of people for you.
Yeah, I gravitate towards those people.
Okay. I find myself doing that as well.
Mm.
But when I spoke to Harris and Zeeshan on the previous episode, I don't think they have that luxury as much.
Mm.
But maybe you recognize it as you get older as well. If it's in you, then you recognize it in others maybe.
Yeah, and if you can develop it in yourself, you can.
So what about on screen? Who's the definition of a man for you on screen?
On screen meaning like some...
Like Ertugrul, for example.
Like Ertugrul, yeah. Ertugrul, if someone asks you that question, Ertugrul will be your one, yeah?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Mm. And Muhammad Ali as well.
Muhammad Ali, yeah. I'm not really of that era of Muhammad Ali. I don't really have...
Well, I'm not either. It was before my time.
And stuff, but yeah. I never saw him in his manly stage. I don't know. On screen, manly man. It's a good one. Trying to think of someone good to say now.
Okay.
I don't want to say Ertugrul. I want to say Bamsi or Turgut. I don't know. Who is it?
Would you say Godfather, Al Pacino?
No.
It's a bit toxic, isn't it?
Yeah, toxic and kind of.
Superman, Christopher Reeve?
No.
IP Man, have you seen Ip Man?
Ip Man, yeah, I've seen Ip Man. No, I don't know if, from what I see of them on screen, as you put it, I don't think they're manifesting the qualities of manliness that, you know, that we've been discussing.
So it's different for you?
It's different, like they are manly in the sense of their physical prowess or their...
But Ip Man, he's very, like, he was always overlooking other people. He was very noble.
Yeah,
very noble.
Ip Man, yeah. Bruce Lee, you know, also
Bruce Lee had a temper on him, you know.
Yeah,
well, and he wasn't that tolerant of others. I don't know. I mean, I don't know him well enough. It's not fair to say that, but just the sense I got.
Yeah.
But Ip Man, definitely, as in the way he's portrayed on screen, very noble. Portrayed,
I guess one thing is the way people are portrayed. They can portray a persona.
And he has a very, he has a lot of nobility to him.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything that I've seen recently that is about embodying these kind of characteristics of manners. We watched a film. What's the name of the film? We watched it at the coffee shop. It was... I can't remember the name of it now.
Okay. You can send it in later if you can't remember.
I'll send it in later. It was it was about that. It was about this man who... the way he was portrayed on screen, the things that they chose to highlight and to manifest about him were these very kind of noble and manly qualities. Oh,
you have to send that in.
Yeah, and I think Haji Mahmood chose the film for that purpose.
Wow.
And it was also about his interaction with the woman as well, the love interest in
okay.
it. You know, and they had a very powerful on-screen chemistry.
Okay.
You know, it worked really well. He was a manly man and she was a very womanly woman.
Okay.
You know, and it worked really well.
So she reveled in her femininity and he reveled in his masculinity.
Yeah, and she kind of drew something out of him that was good, because he was at the start of the film. He's
okay, don't give the spoilers away because I'm going to watch this now.
he's very kind of just wayward and kind of just out for himself. But then she calls him to something higher by being in need. She's in need and he helps
her. But it's not like a damsel in distress thing either.
It's not, because she's also that headstrong and powerful. What is the name of the film? I'll have to check it.
You can I'll send you a link. You can send me a voice message in later.
Okay, sure.
All right. So, last question, which I think I know the answer to now anyway. Do you feel like a man?
Yes.
Okay. Because I asked Harris and Zeeshan yesterday, and they said no, they don't feel like it. And I know a lot of a lot of other guys, if they were very honest with themselves, they would say no. I mean, when I was 27, 28, if I was really honest with myself, the answer would have been no, I don't really. But after 29, it changed.
I feel like I surround myself with some strong characters.
Okay.
And I learn.
And you can handle them, and you learn. Yeah. Because you got to be able to handle the strong character as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time, Yusuf. Thank you this was really fun.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this. Did you?
I did.
It was very good, wasn't it?
It was good.
I'm going to share this with the world.
It's gone quickly. Time's actually flown by.
Does. When you're having fun, it does.
Yeah, yeah. So
all right.
Thanks very much.
Thanks so much. So the movie was called To Have and Have Not, but it stars Humphrey Bogart. So it's quite an old film, I think. I'm going to check it out myself. As well, so he just couldn't remember the name of the movie during the segment. So if you want to go and check it out, let me know what you think. Well, that was a wrap. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any thoughts of your own on this particular episode, then please do get in touch. If you just do a Google search for me at Khurram Malik, I'm at Khurram Malik on Twitter, I'm at Khurram Malik on Instagram, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, reach out to me on any of these networks. And if you have some thoughts of your own that you'd like to share, I can send you a voice message link where you can send in your own voice messages. And then we can share them in the next episode or at some convenient time. But if you feel anything you want to share, anything you want to say, anything you want to ask me, anything you want to talk about, the whole purpose of this podcast is to create discussion, is to create discourse, but civilized discourse, of course. I can't believe that has to be said in this day and age, but it's a disclaimer I want to put in there. But yeah, I'd love to speak to many people about this as possible. And I specifically say people, I want to speak to men and women, old and young, from England and from America and from anywhere, from Japan, wherever you are. Let's get all sorts of views, let's get all sorts of ideas, and let's talk about this. And for now, peace out.